Hey, this is Jason Sean Alexander, creator and artist, writer of Empty Zone, and the artist on Spawn. You are listening to 11 O'Clock Comics.
Hopefully all the bugs have vacated the premises, and we'll be able to hear Jason this episode.
We'll see. It's been a couple days. We'll find out.
I don't think they believe you.
How dare
you? How dare you? I don't think they believe you. It's okay.
What's she up to these days?
I don't know. She just kind of vanished.
She's still fighting that climate fight?
Oh, yeah. You know, she definitely said something recently. Not all that recently. I think sometime last year I saw her name in something.
Good for her.
Yeah.
It's amazing that someone speaking the truth can piss off a bunch of people like she did.
Ruth Hurt, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. Big time.
Just bury your head in the sand. You'll be okay. Until the wave comes.
Yeah. Oh, she was arrested at a climate protest at Hague.
Good girl.
2 weeks ago.
Oh, there you go. Nice. Even busy.
Yeah.
And we were busy.
Long style.
Because we read a whole bunch of comics, and we're bringing them to you this episode, 11 O'Clock Comics, episode 917. And I'm Vince B. Yeah.
You are Vince B. I am David A. Price.
Indeed you are. And I, of course, am Tinkerbell, but you can call me Tink.
Oh, I see what you're doing. Continuity. Mm. You are not Tinkerbell, because I would look at you in a totally different light if you were. You're Jason Wood, everybody, here together on another average everyday episode of this thing brought to you by CheapGraphicNovels.com. CheapGraphicNovels.com have everything. They have a huge selection of omnibus editions, trade paperbacks, OGN, manga, all that stuff at a fraction of that tiny little price printed on the back. Plus the Marvel sale, 50% plus off Marvel trades and hardcovers. Just go there. You're going to find something. And when you do, you're going to order it. You're going to get an email receipt saying, hey, thank you. You're going to respond to that email receipt saying, 11 O'Clock Comics sent me. And Max is going to give you free shipping on your next order. Savings on top of savings. It's like a sandwich of savings. Eat hearty, people. CheapGraphicNovels.com. I am still drinking the Sam Adam because I just love saying it.
I'm having a lemon lime G0.
Ooh. Look at you.
I decided, since I still had some from last week, and I still have some this week, so I'm not finishing it. I enjoyed it so much that I had to go back to the 914 bourbon from Westchester, right here in Westchester.
Nice, nice. On to the comics.
Yes.
I'm excited.
Yeah.
I don't normally do this. I talked about this series briefly in the past. I think criminally so. But my interest in it was reinvigorated by an email we recently received from Marvel.
Mm.
Yes.
It's a little
promotional email saying that this summer, Steve Orlando, who's been helming the 2099 universe, is going to do Annihilation 2099. And it's going to be 5 issues. We're going to see, of course, Miguel O'Hara, Spider-Man 2099, Star-Lord, Red Hulk, Silver Surfer, Nova, Dracula, all the 2099 versions. Well, in Dracula's case, it's the same character. But art by Ibrahim Robertson, Jose Luis, we have Pete Woods, Ario Antido, and guess what? Dale Eelsham's going to illustrate an issue. So what's the deal with this? So, I went back and I reread Miguel O'Hara, Spider-Man 2099. It's a strange miniseries. Because it's 5 issues, and every issue is a done-in-one.
And it's almost like he's he's a host. It's not quite a Marvel team up, but it's like it's about somebody. It's about another character that he just happens to be like in there. It's really not necessarily a Spider-Man 2099 story. He just happens to be it. I enjoyed it. Some issues more than others, but please continue.
No, it's almost as if Miguel is a magnet for the horror themed characters of the 2099 universe in this series. Written by Steve Orlando, you have art by Dev Malia, Pramanik, Michael Dowling, Jason Moore, and Stefano Raphael. And it's 5 issues. In the first, you get Blade 2099. In the second, Dracula 2099. The third is Werewolf by Night. The fourth is Terror Incorporated, which lit my whole world on fire. And the fifth is Man-Thing. So the stories are sort of interconnected. Not much. It's a really odd miniseries because when you hear miniseries, you're thinking, okay, I'm going to get a 5-issue story. Not here. They're one-shots. It's almost as if they had planned to do an ongoing and it didn't really sell. So it was just like, we'll end it at 5. But it's very strange. And if I've read the email correctly, Annihilation 2099 is going to be more of the same, where you have 5 issues, somewhat connected. I from what I inferred from the email, Dracula 2099 is going to be the big bad. And that's cool, because in the Miguel O'Hara Spider-Man 2099, the Dracula issue is the one with the most meat on the bones. Like, just to encapsulate what's going on, Dracula is trapped in Moon Knight's crypt on the moon. And he needs a ride back to Earth. See, Dracula was pissed that he and his people in Terra Rubra, which was the vampire capital, they were toasted by an orbital solar blast. And the survivors encased Dracula in a coffin, of course, lined with native soil, and shot him to the moon. And he's convalescing on the moon, healing. And when this story takes place, Drac wants to return to Earth to both avenge his people and drink some of that sweet, sweet blood. But what he doesn't know is that mankind has concocted this band-aid for the vampire plague. They created an entire planet for the vampires, which would make Mario Bava very happy. What they did was, there's this nanite treatment that turns water into blood. So they found this planet, and they terraformed it, and they turned all of the water into blood. So you have vast oceans of blood. The place is called Domus Draconum. And now your vampire doesn't need to hunt, doesn't need to prey on... There's no victims involved. Take a dive into this blood ocean, drink your fill, and, you know, convalesce. Kick back. Siesta. But vampires need someone to lead them. So the leader of this Domus Draconum is none other than Dracula's daughter, Lilith. And she's depicted exactly as she appeared on the cover of the June 1974 issue of Marvel's Giant-Sized Chillers, #1, featuring the Curse of Dracula. It's an ersatz Giant-Sized Dracula, #1, without the name. Because if you go back issue diving and you want to buy all the Giant-Sized Dracula, you will find that there's not a Giant-Sized Dracula, #1. It's this book, Marvel's Giant-Sized Chillers, featuring Curse of Dracula, #1. So anyway, I'm looking at Lilith and this Dracula thing. I'm like, oh, this would be really cool as a premise for something bigger, because Dracula's pissed. His people were annihilated, hence the name. And now Dracula wants revenge. That's what I'm thinking this Annihilation 2099 is going to be. But it's cosmic, right? You have Nova 2099 and Silver Surfer. I don't know how Red Hulk 2099 plays into it. But you give me Red Hulk and I'm happy, right? I'm just excited because this miniseries, Steve Orlando's doing a really good job, I think, with the 2099. Taking the Wayback Machine, giving us something with which we're very familiar, and injecting a little bit of novelty into it. Because I don't remember ever, I bought all the 2099 books, I don't remember ever seeing Dracula enter the picture. So that's a good thing, as far as I'm concerned. I'm jazzed for this. I know Jason's mileage may vary. He'll probably humor me and let me talk about it. But at least I can get Dap, the more sensible comic book reader, to come on board with me and read this thing.
I will. I'll be there. Because I did read the 5-issue Nagello, and that was weird. It's because we've had Symbiote Spider-Man 2099, we've had just, you know, Spider-Man 2099 relaunches.
Symbiote Spider-Man 2099 is not a bad book. I've been reading it. It's 2 issues today. No, it's not bad.
Yeah. I've got the first issue somewhere here. This miniseries, there was one thing that of course I had to laugh at, and that was so it's Miguel O'Hara, Spider-Man 2099. That's the title of the book. It's not like it's the same Spider-Man 2099 book from 1990 whatever. But the third issue of this limited series says this is the 100th legacy issue. So I love it when it always cracks me up. It's so,
that's Marvel.
I know. Yeah. It's silly but I thought the art across all 5 issues was pretty good. I liked some more than others. It's funny that Vince says that the issue with the most meat on its bones, the one that, of course, featured Dracula, the hero that enlisted Miguel was Moon Knight, who's barely in it because they're barely alive in the story.
And it's a woman.
And it's, yes, Khonshu is a woman. But yeah, so we've got Blade, we've got Moon Knight, we've got Werewolf by Night, Terror, and a techno warlock looking man thing. And it was, I didn't know what to expect. I read the first issue and I'm like, oh, okay, that was a complete story. And then I read the next one and I was like, oh, okay, I see what we're doing.
Yeah, it's really strange.
We're doing
it. It's a very atypical approach to the miniseries. But if I'm being totally honest, and I always am, the Man Thing issue was my least favorite. Mm. Like I expected a techno organic Man Thing because it is 2099, but you don't mess with my Man Thing like that.
I also wasn't thrilled with the antagonist in the issue. They did kind of get a bit weaker as the series continued. I mean, even the Terror was interesting, but it was more for shock and violence.
I think Terror's a great character. I've always liked that character because it comes from the Powerverse books and Critical Mass and you know, St. George.
Is that Powerline?
Powerline, yes. Those books, that's where Terror came from. And I've always loved the character. I thought it's a really neat character. It has to replace organs and stuff. It's cool. But I thought the art was serviceable.
They were also all for the most part, they're all also about revenge.
Okay. Well, it's a big thing. Yeah.
It is.
Yeah. It's not, the visual depiction of these stories was like fine, serviceable to good. There wasn't an issue that was like, holy mackerel, that's a beautiful looking issue. It's an okay looking book. The meat for me was the storytelling, where I thought Orlando did a really neat job just manipulating what we know and the novelty aspect of it, like injecting new blood, pun intended, into the 2099 universe by sticking Dracula into it. That's really fun. Because it is the same Dracula. Because he even berates Miguel for not being the Dracula that he knows, or the Spider-Man that he knows. He's like, "You're not that guy." So it's fun. But
it is, yeah.
As a springboard to other things, I think it's a fun little time waster of a series. It's, you know, it's, I hate to say this, but it's visually it's not going to win any awards. But if this miniseries plants the seeds for greatness down the line, then I'm good with it. And I enjoyed it as it is, but it's the potential inherent in this series that really has me going. Like, I think Blade 2099 is a great character. He needs to eat meat. He's a zombie, but a vampire zombie. But he doesn't want to prey on the innocent, so he 3D prints meat. That's fun. That's a cool little way to solve that problem.
That's clever. Yeah. That's clever.
Yeah.
And Bradshaw's covers are pretty cool too.
The Bradshaw's covers are great. Yeah.
Yeah. But I think since we all know who Miguel O'Hara is, we all know who Spider-Man 2099 is, whether you were reading the comics or you watched the two movies, that's not a character you really need to get to know. So I thought the idea, the conceit of, like Vin said, of having supporting guests show up, then at least it lets you know. And these are characters who could very well, they kind of all, maybe you could say, owe Miguel a favor, and he'll cash it in during the Annihilation event. So
you could see the floor plan for this entire series. It's all the Marvel monsters. In the first issue, Miguel's mother's bitten by what looks like a zombie, but it's not. It's a person exposed to this virus that was supposed to make the human organism immortal. No sickness, no aging, no death. And instead, it makes them super strong, friggin' mean, and entirely willing to pass on the contagion. So you get Tomb of Zombie in the first one. You get Tomb of Dracula in the second. You get Werewolf by Night. I think the Terror Incorporated is the curveball, but then number five, you get Man-Thing. So it's like, let's just take the Marvel monster characters and make a nice little Halloween seasonal monster romp with Spider-Man 2099 in the middle. Now, and if you like the Marvel movies, the 2099 Spider-Man you saw in the Spider-Verse movies is not the same Miguel O'Hara that's in these comics. So don't confuse the two. The one in the movies is only Spider-Man 2099 in name only.
Yeah.
Pretty much. Yeah. So, okay. These are great. They're fun. They're a very rewarding waste of time. I think that's...
It's a waste of time if you got joy out of them.
No, what I mean was, you know, we just engage in pastimes that expend what time we have on this planet. So if you're expending time on this, yes, I guess I shouldn't say it's a waste of time. It's a very worthwhile expenditure of a couple hours. There you go.
Yeah,
you can ask for a comic.
I think so. It's not Watchmen. but it's fun. Yeah. Jason, what are you reading there?
Not that.
I would never expect you to read it.
Well, there's a little series called Fables.
Oh, which, look at that.
Which wrapped up for the second time this month. It took close to, if not a little more than 2 years for Fables to wrap up this time. It was a 12-issue arc, 151 to 162. But as we know, the powers that be and Mr. Bill Willingham took a pretty major issue with DC halfway through the relaunch, and basically declare all of his characters as public domain, and it just got a little messy there. But I think some of us wondered if we were ever going to get the end of this arc because of that. But we did, in fact, have a conclusion, and I'm very glad for it. The entire 12-issue arc is called The Black Forest. It takes place the issue 151 takes place literally minutes after the end of Fables as we knew it, issue 150, which I guess spoilers for what, 10-year-old run. I don't remember when it ended, but the Fable characters who live on Earth have been exposed through the final battle that they had with Mr. Dark. And so all of the spells that they had used to hide in plain sight in New York City all those years is now over. And so the Mundy world, the human world is now fully knows that they exist and has to come to terms with it. And so as Willingham is wont to do, there are multiple story arcs going through the narrative, one of which is the Mundys, including the mayor. Dealing with this new reality of being out and proud in the middle of New York. Many of the Fables after this happens understandably go back to the other world with which they had originated. And for those that don't know the series well, most of the Fables on our earthly plane were there because they were driven away or left their more classic environments because of Geppetto, who was the big bad of the 150 issues, and was an emperor basically of everybody, and so they were on Earth trying to sort of be safe from him. But now that he's been defeated and they don't want to be out in public, they go back to they disperse back to from whence they came for the most part. There's an arc with one of my favorite characters, Cinderella, and Cinderella, always being the opportunist, takes this new reality as a way to gain power by basically showing up at the, I don't remember if it was the CIA or the FBI, and basically saying, you've got a Fables problem, you don't know how to deal with it, I am your answer, and basically becomes a very important, because she's a spy in the comic, as you know, Vince, but so she's listen, I've always been a spy, I'm arguably the greatest spy ever, and so I'm going to be your spy and help you control the Fables. So that's her arc. The big bad of this 12 issues, which is what I alluded to in the last two episodes intros, is Peter Pan, and his enforcer is Tinkerbell. Tinkerbell in this world is almost like a genie. She is this incredibly powerful primordial force that Peter Pan has used magic to entrap. So she does his bidding and is his sidekick, but only because she's forced to. So Peter Pan is sort of machinating to try and assert power. We've come to find out that he actually was the man behind the man. He actually was the one that allowed Geppetto to gain all that power and so forth. And then I'd say the crux of the book, the part that I enjoyed the most, is that Bigby, Snow White, and their cubs go to Bigby's home world, which he hasn't been to in centuries, and set up camp in the Black Forest. And they're just trying to live a pretty simple life, setting up a camp, just living out their days. But all the people, all the creatures and the people that live in the Black Forest now are none too pleased on this, because he comes back and he says, I am here. I reclaim this. This is my world. I'm the boss, but I'll go about your business. Just leave us alone and I'll leave you alone. And so the people that over the centuries had built up a power structure there are none too happy, and they want to try and do something about it. But again, how do you can't come at Bigby Wolf easily. I mean, he's basically one of the most powerful beings in the Fables lore. And so you kind of have to really treat him with kid gloves, even if you're pissed at him. And once they get set up, send their cubs, who are also extremely powerful, to go on an adventure. He says, hey, listen, it's time for you all to go on your own adventure. So go out and have a grand adventure and don't come home until you do, which pisses Snow off as the doting mom. She's like, you just drove our kids away. And he's like, listen, they're immortal. They're gods. They'll be fine. They need to have adventures. And a lot of the 12 issue arc is the cubs getting into their adventures, which vary. There's all, each one gets into various adventures that are befitting of their personality type and their character. And so all these things are going on together, and it sounds probably very complicated, but anyone that read Fables as it was coming out knows that this is really where Willingham and Buckingham shine, integrating all of these different stories and arcs together seamlessly. So that you read this really rich book that feels much, much longer and fuller than 12 issues. And, you know, for me, it was a wholly satisfying experience. I know for some, they were frustrated with the how long it took to come out, and some were frustrated with the fact that Peter Pan is built up to be the big bad throughout the whole arc and then is pretty quickly dispatched in issue 161 with not much trouble. But I'm fine with that. I think the point of it was just to get a taste back into this world again and to tell some stories, some hanging chads, I think, that they wanted, and some itches they wanted to scratch. And I think Peter Pan was just a vessel for that. I don't think, you know, this isn't – it'd be one thing if they were bringing it back as ongoing and Peter Pan was going to be the big bad for 50 or 100 issues. But that wasn't the point here, you know, so I don't really see that as a valid complaint, at least not from my eyes. And he's dispatched by Tinkerbell because, like a gene, at one point during the sort of penultimate or the ultimate battle, the good guys free Tinkerbell from her captivity and – nothing, you know, nothing like a woman scorned, right? So once she's free, she shows Peter Pan just how powerful she is when she's not under his control, and absolutely gaffles him. So yeah, I loved it. And of course, I mean, I'm talking a lot about the story, but this was another chance to see Mark Buckingham art for 12 issues, dude. And like, his work on Fables is just flawless.
Yeah.
And issue 162 is as gorgeous and detailed, and every line is perfectly drawn, and he does not know how to take a panel off. There's no John Byrne panels with no backgrounds. There's No, we all love Byrne, but Byrne is the master of that. There are many books that he did where there were no backgrounds, and it was fine. It was fine for telling the story, but that's not Buckingham's style. Buckingham, not only is every panel beautifully rendered and he never takes a panel off, but then, as you know, he draws these intricate borders around the pages of the book, which take an ungodly amount of time that most artists would say, what's the point? And I think he was as beautiful with issue 162 as he was with issue 1. And, you know, hat tip to him. He's one of the guys we've never had a chance to meet because he doesn't come to US cons very often, but I would really love for the chance to meet him and shake his hand because this is just top notch stuff. So I'm really thrilled that it came back. You know, I think it was really nice. I wouldn't have needed it. I mean, I thought it was one of those series that had a really fantastic ending when it did at 150. But I think since they did decide to come back, I certainly think they held up their end of the bargain. I enjoyed it quite a bit.
Did it seem truncated at all based on?
No, I mean, it was announced as a 12 issue series.
Oh, okay.
From the start. So it took a long time to come out, I think, because of that. But if you go back and look at the solicit for 151, it was the, you know, one of 12 issue series. So that's how it was pitched.
So in this respect, you can go back home.
I think so. I mean, I think your mileage may vary. I know some people on the Slack weren't as into the way things wrapped up because it doesn't really end. The issue 162 is basically an epilogue that sets most of the characters that are in this in new adventures, which if we're to believe Bill, will never get a resolution to because he's done with it. But I'm fine with that. That's fine. Like, I never have an issue with being brought into a world and then being brought out of it without some kind of grand conclusion. I think that's great. Just as long as you entertain me while we're in that world, it's totally fine to remind us that these characters are going to continue to exist. And of course they are. That's the point of them. They're eternal ideas. They're time-tested ideas and forces of nature come to life. And so needless to say, they are going to live on for centuries beyond this with many, many more adventures and stories. So I don't know why that would upset anybody that we didn't get some like magical, you know, ribbon where everybody dies or everybody lives happily ever after. That's not the point of this. You know, that's not the point of these stories.
Did you not read the previous 150 issues?
Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah, I did. Exactly. Yeah.
There you go.
This was something I decided to just give a try on a whim. And I really didn't even know that these two titles were connected until I read the preview pages in the back of this first issue. So first book is called The One Hand, published by Image, written by Ram V, art by Lawrence Campbell, Lee Lowridge on colors. Adita Bitikar on letters. The one hand is created by Ram V, Dan Waters, and Lawrence Campbell. And Dan Waters is responsible for the second book. So this one is the year 2873. The location is Neo Novena. And we are introduced to detective, about to be retired detective, Ari Nasser. And his claim to fame is the one hand case. And the way the logo is on the cover, the murder scene had a bunch of these little squared off characters, these basically whatever kind of alphabet it was supposed to represent, their the killer would write out these letters on a wall in the victim's blood, and there was a handprint at the end of the statement. So Nasser, we established that that the detective likes to he phrases it, he likes to chew on things. He's deliberate. He doesn't mind repetition or a little pain as long as it gets him somewhere. So he can take his time with a case. There's no rush as long as everything lines up, makes sense. If at the end of the day you get the guy you're supposed to get, then that's what's important. But he, while he is walking back to the office for his little congratulations, you're retiring party, there seems to be another murder, a very similar MO to the person who has been arrested and is in prison serving out his term for being the one hand killer. Turns out that while he's not really celebrating, but while he's out with the rest of the department, a person who, a fellow detective who is eventually going to be his partner on this case, goes into the lieutenant's office, and Ari notices the file and asks questions. So yeah, it turns out, hey, here's the case again, and even though it's pretty much his last day, he lets everybody know he needs to see this through. So when he gets to the motel and is checking out the crime scene, he's convinced it's their guy, and his partner's trying to figure out, you know, how he can tell, and he says it's the cipher on the wall. They never released photographs, so whoever is aware, whoever did this knows about the previous times. But there's something slightly different this time around. So Ari's going to walk the streets, think about it a little bit. Apparently he spent some time at we'll call it a brothel, but the staff here, they're all, they're basically, they're not clones. They're basically, but they're just, they're not real people. They're animatronics. Very, very similar to like Blade Runner. Just, I'll think of the replicants that way. So when, Ari's not necessarily thinking that he's going crazy, but he just needs to figure out what the hell is going on. So he notices that when he gets to the handprint, that just something just a little extra, by the pinky of the right hand, kind of off to the side of the palm, and he comes to the conclusion that the suspect might have six fingers, and that is where the supplemental book is titled The Six Fingers. It's created by Dan Waters, Raina V, and Sumit Kumar. Sumit is the artist on this book. Lee Lorig is still your colorist. Vidikar is still your letterer. But this visually looks a little different, but this is actually from the POV of the killer. And the person who's doing, who left the note, is not necessarily somebody, well, on the surface, he isn't somebody that that you would think would do something like this. Johan is a, he works, well, what he'd like to do is be an archaeologist. He goes to, he attends a school where he offers all this information to his professors, and even though it's going to be a costly trip, he has everything planned out, and he opens up his binder and all the pages are missing. There's no idea what the hell happened to his work. So they're just like, all right, well, when you figure it out, come back to us. So he's on the phone with his girlfriend, reaches into his bag as he gets ready to work, because he's at the East End Peninsula Power Factory. He works at an area. He works where basically there's a lot of waste in this area. The batteries and basically just it's not. You got to wear the hazmat suit. It's not a good place to be. But he reaches his hand into his bag before he puts his bag in his locker, and he notices the red substance on his fingers when he pulls his hand out of the bag. There seems to be like a rag or tattered paper. And he, even though he's supposed to do something with his girlfriend tonight, there was a, the storage overheated again, and, there's toxic battery water all over their workspace. So, he's going to suit up and clear the blockage so everybody can get back to work. Unfortunately, he's there and he does clear it. And that's right when the, well, again, I'll call them replicants or cogs. They're there to fix the problem, but he already did. So they just pull him out of the room, and he goes to get checked out in the medical ward. And, yeah, it turns out that, he, even though he's got to take these pills, these anti-mutagen pills, it might be too late, because it does look like he's got something small growing out on the right, on the outer side of his right hand. I just thought the way that, and we're introduced to his girlfriend, and Johan likes to manipulate and control situations, so I can kind of maybe see how he ends up being the type of person who would do this. Getting back to the one hand, Ari meets up with the, he goes to the prison to talk to the person he had arrested for the murders. That doesn't necessarily go the way anybody planned it, but seeing this mystery, seeing these two books, and actually, and there was a moment that happened, I think, in the second issue of The One Hand, that was a very subtle, if you've read enough comics, it's something that would stand out, but generally, you know, just bumping into somebody on a sidewalk, you wouldn't necessarily think of it if it's a crowded street, rainy night. But somebody bumps in to Detective Masser on the street. That scene also plays out on Six Fingers, when we see it from the other perspective. I'm curious to see, I'm interested in this, see how it plays out as far as how Masser ends up catching this guy. If he does, what Johan does as maybe whatever madness he's struggling with is overcoming him. I had no idea. I read the first issue, like I said, of The One Hand, and it was interesting enough. Read the second one, and that's when I read the first issue of The Six Fingers, and then the third, and then the second. So I like the way they're staggering one on one off. But I don't know where the hell we're going with this. It was completely out of the blue. Kudos to everybody involved in it. It wasn't something that I was expecting to check out from Image anytime soon, but I'm glad I did. I had no idea what the hell to expect, and really, I didn't know that there was supposed to be a kind of a second series to go along with it. It wasn't until I saw the preview pages and noticed that the logos of the books are very, very similar, down to the layout and the design of the covers. They do seem, I don't think you could read, I don't, you could probably read The One Hand on its own. I don't know if you could read The Six Fingers on its own without knowing what's going on in the other book. But I, like I said, pleasantly surprised, really, really curious to see where it goes from here. If you haven't, I would, I'd suggest checking it out.
Remember, cheapgraphicnovels.com going to get you the stuff you want at the price you're going to pay. All the stuff we talk about at a fraction of the retail price, plus a massive Marvel sale. Hardcovers, trade paperbacks, all that stuff available to you at 50% off and sometimes more. What's to lose? Nothing. Plus, check out our Patreon page, patreon.com/11oclockcomics. Bonus episodes, downloads, polls, pages and covers and drawings a day. It's just a whole lot of fun. Plus the people. That's the best part. Patreon.com/11oclockcomics. I recently signed back up to the Desert Island Mystery Mail.
Mm-hmm.
I was doing it for about a year, and then it kind of, the wave kind of receded. Like there was a couple of months that were really hot, and then there was a couple months that weren't. And so it's a good deal, but it's all random. In case you don't know what this exactly is, for $38, including postage, you can sign up for Desert Island, the Brooklyn Institution, their mystery mail. And you don't know what you're going to get, hence the title. So you'll get some months click, some months don't. That's the whole mechanic. And there was just a couple, maybe 3 months in a row that didn't click with me. So I was like, I'll come back to this. And I did. Because on Instagram, they let a little clever bit of promotion out that in the next mystery mail, they were going to have a book by Paquito Bolino. And I'm a huge fan of Le Dernier Cri, and I'm probably mispronouncing that. That's how I roll. And Paquito is a very singular voice in art. Uncompromising, no holds barred, very explicit, very grotesque. And they let slip that he was going to have a collage book in the next mystery mail. So I'm like, sign me back up, baby. And it's called Undead. What it is an amalgamation of kitschy sideshow images, vintage comic book covers, tattoo art, extremely explicit pornography, anatomical images, mixed with Marvel covers and DC covers. I'm looking at Sergeant Rock right now. Bondage, luchadors, and for some reason, he has a penchant for The Amazing World of Gumball. Because Gumball and siblings show up more than once. And this is in the tradition of Hoppital Brute, where they aim to offend. That's the whole thing. They just aim to elicit some kind of reaction in the viewer, more often than not, revulsion. And I equate this art with the kind of, it connects before language kicks in. Mm-hmm. And thought. There's a narrative going on within all of these collages, and it's somewhat sequential in the fact that most of it is the same commentary, but it's not, it's very profane. There's a lot of fun poked at institutions. And if there's a sacred cow, chances are Mr. Bellino will eviscerate it within his images. Disturbing, to say the least. And it's not for everyone. But I really love his work. And hence the fact that I jumped back on. It's a full color. I don't know how many pages. A bunch. Full color magazine, just littered with shock value and eye candy. They even take the masthead for Bring On the Bad Guys. And there's, in the very same image, it's the Marvel Bring On the Bad Guys trade paperback masthead is there. And there's two women going at it very explicitly with Fred and Barney looking on. It's ball gags aplenty and lots of blood. It's great. So if you're adventurous and you're looking for something that you're probably not going to see anywhere else, then get yourself some Paquito Bolino's Undead. Sale to Minors is forbidden. On the cover, he's got the green slime. One of my favorite movies of all time. Little green slime in the corner with, there's a lot of repetition of the eye. Injury to the eye, just plain eyes. Anatomical drawings of the eyes. Eyes are very prevalent in this book. Whatever the narrative is, it's there. But like I said, it's not something that thought is not involved. And I'm not downplaying the art, but there's a connection between the viewer and art that begins without thought and without word. And that's where this stuff resides. Like, it's just an overall feeling of stuff that these pictures and words imparts. And then you can try and slice them apart and decipher them. But again, it's a language unique to Mr. Bellino, and you just got to experience it. You can't put words to this stuff, but I love it so much. So maybe pick it up at Desert Island because they published it. Yeah, they published it. God bless them.
They're good folks.
Yeah.
In your travels, I am not going to put too deep onto this, only because it's only the first issue of the sequel. Cannot wait to see where we go from here. But Minor Threats, The Fastest Way Down, picks up where shortly after the first Minor Threats miniseries ended, in Redport City, where the Queenpin, a.k.a., well, Playtime is the Queenpin of Redport, but we're shown that, how things are being run in the city now that Stickman is gone and the criminals are pretty much in charge. And with a bit of a little bit of a cliffhanger, introduced to some other characters that aren't real happy with the way, with how things played out in the first series. So we'll see what this group called the Action, how they're going to deal with Playtime and her crew. Art is still amazing. Same creative team. We got Patton Oswalt and Jordan Bloom on writing, Scott Hepburn on art, with Ian Herring on colors, Nate Picos on letters. But same great art, still witty, still clever, introducing a few characters that you may or may not care about and may want to see done away with. the Holiday Squad is definitely a group that I wouldn't mind seeing get theirs. But I thought the violent as hell, but still a lot of fun. I'm a little worried for Frankie, but I'm hoping that she isn't in too much trouble. But she seems to be dealing with some battles on multiple fronts, whether it's this crew who wants to get to the end, at the bottom of what happened with Stickman, or a development company that wants to tear down buildings and build up new high rises. Of course, that is where Frankie's mom lives. So there's some stress, but yeah, I'm all in again for to see where this series goes. I still also have the alternates to read, but yeah, In Your Travels, Minor Threats, The Fastest Way Down, number one.
In Your Travels, I'm going to bring you back to the DC superhero world for a character that I don't know that I've talked a lot about over the years, but I do like, and that is Green Arrow. I read Green Arrow 1 through 10 of of the new launch, which was started mid last year by Josh Williamson, the writer who's these days like the writer du jour at DC. He's kind of like their big shtocker these days, I guess. And for the most part, the artist penciler is Sean Izakse, with a really fun fill-in two issues by none other than Phil Hester, which you gotta love. But it's a fun time. Like I said, I've always liked the character. This has a lot of feel goods for people that I think are probably nostalgic for the character more than I am. It starts where, now this all takes place as most of the books that rebooted last year, directly after the events of, what is it? Dark Crisis, right? That's the last one, which I didn't read. So, but you didn't need to. It's just, the point is that things are shuffled, right? And we're kind of getting our arms around the new status quo. In this status quo, Oliver has been shunted off into a faraway planet. A planet so far away that the Green Lanterns don't even have a sector there. And he's still kind of doing his Green Lantern thing. You know, he's still fighting the good fight, trying to keep people safe, or aliens safe, as it were. And then on Earth, they're all trying to figure out where Ollie is, and the whole crew is involved. You've got Black Canary, of course. You've got Roy. You've got Connor Hawk. You've got Arrowette, all the Arrow characters, basically, or even a brand new one, she is his niece. I don't know, because I'd never heard of her before, but I'm sure she's appeared other places. Point is, you've got like 7 or 8 different Arrow characters all getting up into cahoots, trying to figure out where he is. And it's just a fun time. Over the 10 issues, there's a arc with the Legion of Superheroes, because Ollie keeps getting shunted off into different times and places, and he shunted into that future where the Legion is. There's a part of the run where they're trying to track down Sanctuary. Talk about a throwback to Tom King's Heroes in Crisis. Never thought I'd see that again. And just a bunch of different interactions. This is still during the time when the Justice League doesn't exist. Still, I believe, continues to not exist. And I just thought it was a lot of fun. Isaac Zay is a classic superhero artist, you know, like just really super clean lines, really energetic. It just great at doing sort of big splash pages with teams and characters fighting. So I think he's a perfect, you know, one of many perfect choices for this. And it was fun seeing Hester do his thing, because certainly he, for some of our younger listeners, may not realize he had a very long run on Green Arrow back in the day. So overall, thumbs up. I'm going to keep reading it. It's a fun superhero comic, just, you know, a straight like double down into the gap, like, you know, not a home run, not like a 5 out of 5 where you just, you know, it's going to be competing for Oscars votes, but absolutely a fun part of the stack.
Cool.
Excellent.
All right, everybody, thank you for being here with us this time. Hope you're here next time. Buy some comics, read them, enjoy them, love them, talk about them. what better things are there out there? Not much. Come back next time. We'll probably be talking about them. Say goodnight. Warriors.
Where's the music, dude?
You can't do it. I told you, David.
Good night.
No PC, no music.
You see these nuts?
Yep. Tiny.
Depends on the weather.
Does the humidity affect them?
Well, you know, they hang low in the heat. They squinch up in the cold.
Okay. Yeah, that is lovely. Tell them how much you feel about them. Without mentioning your nuts.
Oh, well, so much. Yeah.
That's where my hands are.
That's it for that one.